This episode of Dean Bakari's Meaningful Show is brought to you by Flashbooks, where you can get best-selling business and self-improvement book summaries that you can read or listen to in under 20 minutes. To learn more and get started for just a buck today, visit www.getflashnotes.com. Welcome to the Meaningful Show podcast, where every single week we work to bring you an inspiring insight, idea, or interview to help you live better, work better, and be better both in life and in business. Brought to you by MeaningfulHQ.com, we've got one very simple goal here on this show, and that is to help you do more of what matters and less of what doesn't. I'm your host, Dean Bakari, and if you're ready, then I'm ready. So let's get into it. Hey, what's up? It's Dean Bakari. Welcome back to the show. Today, I am joined by Cal Newport, who's the author of two awesome books dedicated to helping us maximize our potential and cultivate more meaningful lives, both personally and professionally. His first book, So Good They Can't Ignore You, Why Skills Trump Passion and the Quest for Work You Love, as the title entails, is all about debunking the sort of old advice that everyone's heard about how blindly following your passion is going to make you happy, arguing instead that it's not necessarily doing what you love that makes us love what we do, but doing really well at what we do that helps us cultivate a deeper sense of meaning and love for the work that we do. So today he's here to talk with us about his new book, Deep Work, Rules for Focused Success in a Distracted World, which to me seems like an extension off of So Good They Can't Ignore You. But Cal will tell us a little bit more about that. So Cal, thanks for being here and welcome to the show.
Hi, Dean.
So talk to me a little bit about, actually, before we dive into Deep Work, what I'd like to do is ask you about the first book, So Good They Can't Ignore You. You asked a question that essentially it seems like was why you wrote the book, the first one, So Good They Can't Ignore You, which was, how do we end up loving the work that we do? How do we end up loving what we do? Can you talk to us a little bit about that and what the answer was that you came up with?
Yeah, I think what was important is that I decided to pursue that question from scratch. So certainly there are a lot of answers out there in our culture, one of the most popular being, if you want to end up loving what you do, you have to follow your passion. So I knew that was out there, but I essentially put that to the side and said, let me go back to first principles. What I'm going to do is I'm going to study the scientific literature that's relevant, and I'm going to study people who do love what they do and figure out what was their path and how they got there. And once you deployed both those tools of investigation, it became clear to me that follow your passion is actually a pretty terrible piece of general advice to give to people. The goal, and I want to make it clear, the goal of ending up passionate about what you do is a good goal. And in fact, that was the goal I was trying to figure out how to accomplish. But the particular strategy of starting with a pre-existing passion and then using that pre-existing passion as the basis of your career decisions, that strategy turns out, when you look into it, to create, for most people, more harm than good.
Right, right. Because it seems to me like it's kind of like you have this expectation of, oh my God, I'm passionate about XYZ, and if I don't find a job that provides me with that specific XYZ, then I got to jump from this job to another one, and then another one, and another one. And
Yeah. It creates tons of anxiety. It creates chronic job hopping. And, you know, the reality of it is most people, especially if you're talking about 21 years old, 20 years old, the years when most people are entering the workforce out of, say, college, most people at this age do not have clear pre-existing passions. So you're already screwing them. you're saying, follow your passion. Like, oh my crap, I don't have a passion. What's wrong with me? So for a massive majority of the population, that creates trouble. And then two, we just don't have a lot of evidence that the match of the job, the specific content of the job to some sort of intrinsic inclination matters that much. I mean, if you study the literature, what does matter, what makes people passionate about their work, has little to do with the specifics of the work you're doing and has a lot to do with more general traits. Like, do you have a sense of autonomy? Do you have a sense of competency? Do you have a sense of impact on the world? Do you have a sense of relationships and connection to people that matter? These type of traits give people passion. And usually it takes a relatively long process of getting good at something before you can guarantee these type of traits in your work. So it's just a different way of looking at it. You're not trying to follow your passion. You're letting your passion follow you as you very deliberately cultivate a job that you are going to end up loving.
Which seems like it's like a combination of embarking on a journey to mastery, but also embarking on that journey while you've set up a proper environment that's kind of conducive for that.
Yeah, that's exactly right. So if you break down the process a little bit more, the most consistent way that people get passion in their work is the reason you pursue mastery is not just because it's intrinsically meaningful, which it is. A sense of competency does make you enjoy your work more. But its secondary effect is that that gives you more leverage over your career. And this is what I found time and again when I study people who really love what they do today. Mm-hmm. There is this element of building mastery, step one. And then step two, using that mastery as leverage in the marketplace to transform their work, to push it towards those traits like autonomy, competence, relationships, impact that matter, and away from stuff that was draining and didn't give them a sense of satisfaction. So in some sense, it's a kind of an economic argument. Good jobs are hard to get. Everyone wants them. A job you love is something that lots of people want.
Right.
So you have to have something to offer in return. And almost always that's going to be mastery of a skill that the market values. So mastery gives you this double impact. One, just by itself, is satisfying. I mean, we're meant to be craftsmen. Craftsmanship is something that's deeply satisfying. But two, if you're really good at something that people value, that's when you can start to transform your job into something that you really love.
Love it. Love it. And so this kind of brings us to deep work, right? Diving into sort of the big idea from your book, can you tell me a little bit about what deep work is essentially about and what you were trying to kind of convey, the message you were trying to convey in the book?
Yeah, and I think it's apt to that you point out that deep work seems like a natural follow-up from my last book, because in many ways it was. There's a lot of readers, myself included, a reader of my own book, who said, okay, if I buy this premise, how do I get really good at valuable things quickly? If that's the key to loving my work, how can I do that as quickly as possible? And in some sense, deep work is the answer to that question. So to give a little bit more details, deep work is what I call the act of focusing without distraction on a cognitively demanding task. So you're giving something your full attention, you're not distracted, it's getting a lot of your time, and you're giving it intense concentration. You're really pushing your brain as far as it can as you work on this task. And the central argument of the book is that right now in our economy, deep work is becoming more valuable than ever before, at exactly the same time that deep work is becoming more rare than ever before. People are losing this ability to do this. And when I see those two things both show up when referring to the same skill, I see a classic economic opportunity. You have something that's becoming more valuable at the same time that it's becoming more rare, means that if you're one of the few to purposefully cultivate this skill, you're going to be like a superstar in our economy.
Right.
It's like a superpower in our current economy. If you're able to consistently put aside time and you've trained yourself to focus intensely in that time, you're just going to be able to operate orders of magnitude above many of your peers. So I make that argument in the first part of the book. And then the second part of the book, we get down to tactics. Okay, if you buy that, how do you get better at this skill?
Right, right. And to just kind of put it in perspective for people, like, you know, it's funny, Cal, because I get emails on a weekly basis, regularly from people listening or reading, asking for tips on how to focus, right? And it seems like they want some different type of answer other than you gotta just block your time, shut the iPhone down or put it on silent, don't look at it for a couple of hours while you're focusing on that one thing that you gotta do, and just kind of wax on, wax off, repeat that process over and over and over again, just changing the context or the type of work you're doing. But it seems like people want something different than that. Yeah. What are some tactics or ideas that you have on that? Because that's kind of essentially what deep work is, right? Undistracted focus, shutting down the notifications on your MacBook and your iPhone and not letting the buzz, Bing, Flash, all that stuff get in the way of focusing on your work.
Well, I think a key observation that I have found helps people make the transformation towards a working life with a lot more depth in it is emphasizing that deep work is a skill and not a habit. And it's an important distinction, because a habit is something like flossing your teeth that you know how to do.
Right.
And all that matters is just you need to do it more, right? I know how to floss my teeth. The point is I need to remember, I just got to be better about doing it every day. A skill, on the other hand, is like playing the guitar. It's something that you shouldn't just expect you know how to do, and it's just a matter of like, oh yeah, I should just play guitar more. It's something that you actually have to train and get better at.
Right.
If you don't practice it, you can't expect to do it well. And I think something that throws people is that deep work is a skill. And so when they have these early attempts to just block off some time and jump into it, it can be a frustrating experience. They find themselves unable to concentrate with any intensity. Their brain is distracted. It's bouncing all around. It's like trying to do mindfulness meditation for the first time that you've ever tried it. It can be this very frustrating experience where right. And you say, well, this felt bad. It strained my mind. I felt distracted and I didn't get anything done. And then that's a bad experience. Much as if you picked up a guitar and just tried to play, it's going to sound terrible. But people who practice guitar, and they're like, well, yeah, obviously I have to practice. The same thing holds for deep work. So there's a lot of specific tactics, but there's three general areas in which specific tactics can help you add more depth. And so the one area has to do with how you actually schedule your day, making sure that there is time on a regular basis to do this type of work. The second type of tactics surround the actual training of the ability to concentrate. How do you get better at concentrating? How do you actually get more cognitive output per unit time spent thinking? And then the third type of tactics are more psychological. And this is where you make changes to other parts of your life that indicate to you that your identity is one of someone who values focus, that you're making some drastic changes. So when people are first getting started, I typically recommend do at least one thing in each of those three categories. If you do one thing in each of those three categories, you're going to be much more likely to persist in your development as a deep worker than if you just do maybe one thing or just focus on one of those categories.
So just really quickly going back to like the skill versus, you know, deep work being a skill rather than a habit, which is a really, really neat point that you made. My question is, isn't it true that skills are a result of regularly practicing habits though?
Yeah, it's right. It's interesting because you have to practice deep work to get better at it. The practicing itself is actually a type of practice. But I think what's important, and here's the important distinction, is that we know from decades of research in performance psychology and neuroscience, we know this from both levels, that in order to improve at something, it's not enough to just do it a lot.
Right.
You actually have to do it deliberately in a way in which you're aiming to stretch and improve your skill. Right. So if you just run the same 3-mile route at the same speed, you're not going to get faster after a while.
Of course.
But if you're doing interval training and pushing yourself, you can get faster. The same thing holds for deep work. You want to do more than just putting aside time and doing it a bunch and hope that your ability to concentrate gets better. You actually want to stretch yourself. You want to actually stretch your mind like you would a muscle with deliberate tactics in order to actually increase it. So for example, a couple things that help is productive meditation. Now, this is an exercise where what you do is you take a problem, a clear professional-related problem. Mm-hmm. You take a period of time. It helps if you're doing some sort of movement, like you're walking outside, for example, or taking a shower. You take one problem and you try to make progress on it in your head. So this could be like in my career as a applied mathematician trying to solve a proof, or it could be trying to outline something that you have to write, or figuring out an algorithm for something you're about to code. And just like with mindfulness meditation, as your attention slips away from the problem and tries to think about 1,000 other things, you notice that, and then you bring your focus back to the problem and
right.
keep trying to dive deeper and deeper. If you do this exercise, you'll discover at first that it's really hard, that you really have a hard time keeping your attention on the one problem you're working on. Your attention will keep wandering, and you have a very hard time pushing deeper into the problem, because that requires you to take things and hold them in your working memory and dive deeper. But if you do that type of straining, deliberate practice again and again, you'll start to notice clear differences. That over time, you notice that you're able to think longer on the problems. Your mind is wandering less. And that's exactly the feeling of increasing your sort of brain as a muscle, just as you might notice with your arm muscles getting stronger if you're doing reps. And I can say from experience, productive meditation is something I spent 2 years doing a few years ago when I was a postdoctoral associate, and it really had a big impact on my own focus. So that's just one example of many of the type of things that can help you relatively rapidly actually build your ability to concentrate intensely. And once you have that ability, you can really start producing sort of profound results.
I love it. I love it. So it's kind of like, for instance, say if you were to use, if a habit's an automatic response to something, right, an automatic sort of behavior that you do without thinking about, getting up in the morning at 5 o'clock, for instance, would be a great example. And what you want to do is get in better shape. So you develop the habit of getting up at 5 a.m. and then you use that to kind of develop the skill of exercising harder or better or more effectively every day when you get up in the morning to achieve your goal. So like directed practice, right? It's kind what I'm basically trying to say is, or trying to kind of get to, is using both habit and skill. Because I have a feeling right now people are like, well, I thought, you know, habits were skills, and I thought you needed both of them. And what's this now? Like, what do you mean you don't need to do this? And you know what I mean? I feel like people are kind of sort of want to be able to use both together. And I think it is important, right? You use your habits to develop your skills, in other words, is what you're saying.
I think that's absolutely right. I mean, okay. For example, going to the gym every morning at 6 a.m. is a habit. But if your goal is to get stronger, you have to then use that habit to support the practice of lifting the weights, you know, when you're there, and lifting heavier and heavier weights and doing repetitions. So when I was saying there's these sort of three classes of tactics that help you develop a deep life, you see both things show up. So we have the one class, which is actually sharpening your ability to focus. And that's things like we talked about, skill building, like productive meditation. And you can do repetition training where you gradually increase the amount of time that you concentrate. The second class of tactics is habit related. And this is the type of habits you put into place that help make sure that you have on a regular basis well protected time for doing deep work, but that you have the right types of rituals and routines surrounding the deep work, that your mind can slip into that mindset as easily as possible. So that's the habits that are supporting the skills. And then we have this sort of third sort of esoteric category, which is doing something somewhat drastic to indicate to yourself that focus is something important. So when people want to do physical fitness, maybe they spend a lot of money on a gym membership to try to indicate to themselves that that's important.
To buy into it, basically.
To buy into it. I advocate similarly serious things for buying into the deep focus lifestyle. And I don't mean to scare people, but for example, I've never had a social media account. And I think for a lot of people, unless their job really depends on it, quitting Facebook would be a good first step in transition into a world of depth.
That'd probably be life-changing for a lot of people.
I can tell you, nothing bad happens.
Your life doesn't end, does it?
Your life doesn't end. I have plenty of friends, but I can tell, you know, a lot of these products are engineered by attention engineers to basically thwart your ability to concentrate. They're made to grab and keep your attention, and a lot of people are paid a lot of money. So it's a weird tension. If on the one hand you're trying to really improve your ability to focus, while on the other hand you're using things that are built to hurt your ability to focus, it's a little bit like taking up running at the same time that you take up smoking.
Yeah, it's totally counterproductive. That's funny. That reminds me of a guy we had on the show about a year and a half or so ago, and his name is Nir Eyal, and he wrote a book called Hooked, How to Design or Build Habit-Forming Products, which you just reminded me of, because these products, these apps, are literally designed to get you hooked, like a candy company designs candy packaging and candy to get kids hooked.
Yep. Yeah, so. Nir's book is great. It's scary.
Yeah.
I mean, I know he uses his powers for good, but getting some insight into what's happening on some of these big internet companies, what they're doing to get your attention. If you're someone who values the ability to focus, and I'm arguing it's really underestimated how much value. We're talking not you get a little bit more productive. I'm talking you get 5 times more productive if you really train your ability to focus. And once you're in that mindset, suddenly you start to see different things differently. Something that was just a fun diversion suddenly becomes a little bit scary. Like, wait a second, that's going to hurt my moneymaker in some sense.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. Have you ever heard of the concept of divided attention, Cal?
Tell me about it.
So, I mean, it's just basically, for instance, say that you're walking your dog, right? That's one activity. And your phone rings all of a sudden while you're walking your dog. You can pick up your phone and walk your dog at the same time and it's no problem, right? Most people can do that. But if you're working at an airport and you're trying to direct 3 different airplanes to land at the airport at the same time and you're behind that console, it's probably not a good idea to be, you know, texting somebody while you're doing that, because it would take away too many of your mental faculties, right? Or if you're performing surgery and you're a surgeon, you probably wouldn't want your surgeon to be texting on the phone so while he's performing heart surgery on your dad or something like that. So I was just wondering if you were familiar with that concept and if you'd written about it in deep work at all.
Right. Well, there's an important evolution of that concept. So there's a lot of research in the last decade about that type of divided attention. Often it was called multitasking as well in the research. And so we have a lot of work by the late Clifford Nass, for example, of Stanford University, among others, who really showed in the laboratory exactly this effect, that there's many type of activities, including the type of activities that people were often doing simultaneously in the late 90s, checking email while on the phone or trying to do a meeting while doing their email, that sort of definitively showed people can't actually multitask. And what happens is they shift back and forth. And I think that message seeped in to some degree. And people are more likely to agree with that premise today. Like, okay, yeah, I get it. If I can't really do 2 or 3 work-related activities at the same time, it's better to do 1 at a time. But there's been an evolution of this research coming from several different angles in the past 5 to 10 years that have been saying, okay, but even if you're unitasking, if you're context switching relatively frequently, you still have this negative effect. Now, one of the terminologies for this is the notion of attention residue, and the concept is pretty straightforward. It says when you turn your attention to something, that starts to occupy your mind, and then when you turn your attention to something else, that first thing leaves a residue on your attention that takes a long time to dissipate, and until it dissipates, you're operating at a reduced cognitive capacity. And they can measure this directly in the lab. If you look at the research of Sophie Leroy, for example, you just give people cognitive puzzles. If you've shown them something else relatively recently before they started working on the puzzle, they're just worse at it.
So in other words, they're still thinking about that thing that you showed them before.
Exactly. And it can take up to 20 minutes or more for that residue to clear out. Now, the reason why this is important is, now let's think about the typical flow of the sort of conscious knowledge worker. The knowledge worker is trying to be careful about multitasking. So what they do today is a typical knowledge worker who cares about attention says, I know, don't leave your email inbox open and don't have a notification that pops up every time an email shows up, because you'll never focus. Instead, what most people tend to do today is, they'll close the inbox, and then they'll open the check it to see if something's there, then they'll close it and work for a while and come back. And maybe they're checking it every 10 minutes, every 15 minutes. You just take a quick glance to see what's in there, and then you go back to your work. And they're not multitasking. That's not multitasking. But attention residue theory says that's the worst case scenario, because what happens is every time you glance at that inbox, not only are you switching your attention, but you're seeing things that you know you need to act on and you aren't able to resolve in that moment. You say, I got to answer that email. I can't do that right now. I need to get to that later. Then when you shift your attention back to the hard thing you're trying to do, you're trying to program something, you're trying to write something, you're trying to solve a problem, you have a large part of your cognitive apparatus that says, no, I'm going to sit here and try to think through, like, what's my response going to be to that email?
Right, am I going to say it back?
And you're operating at this really reduced capacity. So I think the unintended effect is that we have the vast majority of knowledge workers, because they have this frequent context switching. They're unitasking, but frequently switching context, check the email quickly, come back to work, glance at Facebook, back to work. is they're operating at a greatly reduced cognitive capacity. So it's again, to use these sort of athletic analogies, it would be like if you were fielding a basketball team, but you had these heavy weight belts that you had your players holding on to, right? It's hampering people at the main thing they're trying to do. So that's one of the advantages of deep work, is that if you're a deep worker, your approach to work is that you have long stretches of uninterrupted time where you're concentrated intensely, and then you batch all of the shallower stuff into smaller batches so you can give yourself time for that attention to clear out. And it's like because everyone else is doing it, it's almost like you're taking a performance enhancing cognitive drug.
Yeah, it's so true. I like to think of it as bandwidth. Like if I'm, for instance, every single morning I block off for totally uninterrupted time, hours of time, 4 hours to just focus on my most important project for that week. And I don't check email. I don't look at my phone. I don't do anything else, but I just focus on that. I've noticed that just changing, developing that and doing it regularly has massively increased my overall like productivity and effectiveness and you know, just ability to achieve my goals more quickly.
Yep.
And I've noticed that, you know, whereas before it was like, as you were mentioning, if you're going to switch your browser every 15 to 20 minutes and, you know, just shift and technically no longer have to call it multitasking, but just shift your focus. It's so true. It does. It eats away at your bandwidth and makes you less creative, less effective when you go back to doing whatever it is that's more important than checking your email.
Well, you're a case study. So we have a testimonial here, say, about the advantage of a deep lifestyle, that when you have on a regular basis long stretches of focus concentration, and you really take your ability to focus seriously and you improve it over time, the productivity impacts, they just really are massive. You know, I tell the story during the book that I'm someone who's always taken deep work seriously because my day job is a theoretical computer scientist, which means I solve math proofs for a living. And in my field, the ability to focus is everything. If you don't do it well, you lose your job.
If you get one thing wrong, it's totally messed up, isn't it?
Because of the tenure process, right? They look at have you done like a lot of really excellent work? And if not, you don't get to keep your job. And to do a lot of excellent work in mathematics is just how many, can you focus really intensely? That's everything.
Right. Right. Wow. Were there some other, so you also had other examples, right? In the book, in deep work. For instance, you mentioned something about Carl Jung building a stone tower in the woods to focus his mind.
Yeah, I like this idea that there's different, what I call depth philosophies. So there's different ways that you can integrate deep work into your life. And I think it's important to actually articulate the different ways so that people don't get stuck where they say, well, this, you know, what Dean does, I could never do in my schedule, therefore I can't do deep work. It's useful to recognize that there's these different ways that have been successful for people. So, you know, Carl Jung's example, what he would do is he lived in Zurich, and it was a very busy lifestyle. He had a clinical practice psychologist and then was really clued into the coffee house culture and the lecture culture there. Very busy, busy lifestyle. So he built this house out of stone with no electricity or running water, essentially in the woods outside of Zurich. Like you just drive into the countryside for a long time, and then there he has this house in the woods. And his depth philosophy, which I call the bimodal philosophy, was he was in one of two modes, either in a period where he's doing lots of context switching and shallow work, or a period where he was at his retreat in the woods and for 1 to 3 days was just thinking deeply. And so I call that the bimodal approach. A more modern example of that I give in the book is the Wharton professor, Adam Grant.
Give and take.
And he's an amazingly productive professor. He's only a year older than me and is already a full professor at Wharton. Whereas I've just, so, you know, he's this amazingly productive professor, and I talked to him about, you know, how does he do this? And he essentially mimics Carl Jung's bimodal approach, that he's either in a period where his door's open, you can reach him, he's doing give and take, all that type of things, and then, or he's in paper writing mode, where he'll take 1 to 3 days, and it's as if he's on vacation, you can't reach him. He might actually be in his office, and he says it confuses his colleagues, because he'll have an out-of-office auto reply, and they'll say, but I can see you in your office. What do you mean you're out of office? You're clearly in your office. But he's either only doing shallow work, or he's in a long period of only doing deep work. So that's the bimodal approach. But another very common approach, which works for people, is what I call the rhythmic approach. And that's like what you do, which is most days or every day you have a set time that you do deep work. So maybe the first few hours in the morning, or every Friday you take the whole Friday to do it, or you wake up at 5 and do it from 5 to 7:30. And so instead of having long periods of depth and long periods of non-depth, it's a little bit of depth, but regularly every day.
Right.
And that also is very effective. And then you have the extremes. On the far extreme, you have people like the novelist Neal Stephenson, or the famed computer scientist Donald Knuth, who execute what I call the monastic philosophy of deep work, which is where you basically say, all that matters in my life is deep work, and therefore I'm just not going to do any shallow work. And those are examples of people, for example, who don't have a publicly available email address. They don't really, Donald Knuth gave up email in the 1990s. Neal Stephenson doesn't want you to be able to reach him. He has an essay that says, I could either be in touch with a few thousand of you over my life, or I could write some really good books that'll last for a really long time. And I think the latter is more valuable. So like, you can't really reach me on social media. I don't have an email address. Don't invite me to do things. I just want to do deep work. So you have these extremes. And the important point is different extremes work for different people.
Right.
A lot of people's jobs, you're not going to last in that job very long. If you say, I can't be reached, never bother me. Right. I'm just going to sit in a cave. But something like your method, or something like Adam Grant's method, these things do work in a lot more positions. So if you choose the philosophy that's right for your type of work and personality, you're going to have a lot more probability of success.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. Totally agreed. I think it's a lot like, it depends on what you do, right? I remember you just reminded me of something that Stephen Pressfield, the writer, said in an interview I saw a long time ago, where he said, you know, when he wrote, I think it was his first book or one of the books that became a bestseller, he just kind of went out to this cabin in the woods for a year. He saved up all his money and he kind of stashed it away. And he went out to this cabin in the woods and just wrote every single day. Didn't talk to anybody. I think he said he had his dog with him. And he'd like get up like Rocky every morning, stretch a little bit, and then just go and sit behind, you know, his computer or his typewriter and just crank away day after day after day. And until he finally finished his first manuscript, and then he kind of went back to civilization after a year of doing that.
Yeah. I mean, that's deep work in its purest form. You give it enough time, all of the residue clears out. And then over time, you're just able to produce at this high level. You know, I tell the story in the book of a very compressed version of Stephen Pressfield's strategy, which was where the sort of the social media consultant pioneer, Peter Schenkman, had a book to write and a tight deadline. So what he did was he booked a round trip business class ticket to Tokyo. And he got on the plane and he wrote all the way there, and he had an espresso at the airport, an airport restaurant, turned around, flew back, and wrote the whole way back, because there was no possible distraction.
Oh my
up
God.
In the air.
Yeah,
the
airplane mode.
Airplane mode. And he said it was the best $4,000 he ever spent, because in 30 hours he was able to write a whole draft of the book, which kind of emphasizes this point that deep work, again, is not about, oh, it's kind of nice to be less distracted, or maybe you'll be a little bit more productive. We're talking about major multiplier increases, you know, superpower style increases in what you're able to produce.
Absolutely. Totally agreed. Totally agreed. That's good stuff. That's really good stuff, Cal. So let's say you had to choose one big key takeaway from deep work. If there was one thing you would have readers remember and apply in their lives, like, what would it be? If you could say, this is the one thing that I want you to do, if you do nothing else from this book, this is what I want you to do right now and apply in your life.
I would say, okay, if you could only do one thing, say, take your calendar, whatever you use, you know, online on your computer, your calendar, and right now for the next 4 weeks, make sure that you have 5 hours each of those weeks, and it can be spread over a couple days, that are blocked off and marked on your calendar like any other appointment or meeting. Mm. So time that you protect. When someone says, can you jump on a call, then you say, oh, I have a thing.
Right.
Until noon, can you do it later? Or if someone says, oh, you didn't answer my email this morning, you could say, oh, I was in a thing. It's on my calendar. I was in a thing till noon, right? 5 hours, next 4 weeks. And during those time that you have put aside, and I would recommend doing maybe two chunks, 5 hours, it won't be too much. During that time, I want you to have the same thing that you sit down and work on with as much focus and intensity as you can. If you worry about your ability to resist distraction, choose something that you can do without the internet and go to a place where there's no internet. Leave your phone behind. Don't give yourself any possibility of breaking your distraction. 5 hours, 4 weeks, no distraction during those 5 hours, really thinking hard on something important. You'll come out of that month on the other end with a brand new appreciation and ability to put this type of skill to work.
I love it. And as we kind of sort of wind down and come to a close here with the interview, a couple of quick questions that I usually like to ask people. One of which is, what are some of your favorite books in terms of self-development and self-improvement?
Oh, that's interesting. In terms of self-improvement. Well, I'm a very broad reader, so I tend to draw lessons from somewhat unusual places. So for example, one of my favorite books on, you know, focus and the ability to concentrate would actually be The Rise of Theodore Roosevelt, which is this great National Book Award winning epic biography of Theodore Roosevelt. And you get this image in this book, this really well painted portrait of someone who took his ability to give things intense focus and used it to craft this incredibly sort of meaningful and impactful life. This is the type of book where you're going to see stories like Theodore Roosevelt in the badlands of, you know, Montana, in a boat on an ice-choked river pursuing cattle robbers. They're probably were going to have a gun battle, and he's in the front of this boat, rickety boat, in these dangerous ice floes with a bear skin pulled over him, taking advantage of that hour he has to intensely try to read Matthew Arnold, a book, a sort of great social critic, to try to intensely learn something during that period of time he had. He's a guy who could really just turn it on and focus with intensity and built a really cool life. So that book, nice, for example, is a huge inspiration on focus. But essentially, when it comes to self-development, I mean, you can find inspiration. I find inspiration.
That residue is in my mind right now. I'm like thinking about Theodore Roosevelt with bearskin pulled over his head, like on top of this boat.
Anyways, it's great. You got to read this. Crazy. His ability. I even have a chapter in Deep Work about how to have a Theodore Roosevelt day every once in a while as a training mechanism. He's my Deep Work, my unexpected Deep Work hero.
That's awesome. I'm going to check that out. I'm sorry. What you were saying? Continue.
Oh, yeah. Okay. So, I mean, there's a lot of books that have been influential, and a lot of which are sort of serious, focused on self-development. But for the focus stuff, the Theodore Roosevelt's very inspiring. The Shallows by Nicholas Carr is very scary. Mm-hmm. And he really just goes deep into the research about if you live your life in the distraction, what are the permanent effects it has? And I think this really important point that it's not that, you know, hey, it's bad to be distracted, you should try to be focused more. But if you're distracted enough, you're going to lose your ability to focus.
Yeah.
Even if you want to focus. And it's a very smart book that someone even handed and tries to understand, you know, so what does this mean? I mean, I'm not trying to judge it, but just say, we should know this is what's happening to our mind.
Right.
You know, what are we going to do about it? So that's another influential book for me in this general space.
Awesome. Awesome. Yeah. That actually reminds me, because my wife and I just had a baby. She's 5 months old now. And one thing we recently found out about was, if you, like, for instance, you know, with babies, they have no real attention span. You know, there's so many new things that are going on in their lives that they're just learning about and seeing for the first time, that it's, you can't blame them for always looking in different directions and wanting to touch everything. And obviously that's what's happening with our little girl as well. And one thing we just recently found out about was, you know, if you're gonna put some toys in front of your kid, for instance, especially if it's a little baby, don't try to mess around and like put another toy in their purview if they're still focused on that first toy, right? So for instance, if there was a little ball and Nora, our little girl, is playing with that little ball, just let her play with that rather than, you know, grabbing the stuffed animal from the corner of the room and putting that in front of her, and then grabbing that little thing that makes noise that you press buttons with and putting that in front of her. Just let her enjoy playing with this little ball, because the long-term impact apparently is that it is more, it's conducive to a lifestyle that's filled with distraction. It's teaching her how to be distracted rather than allowing her to focus and learn from one activity at a time, which I thought was really interesting.
That's fascinating. Yeah, I have two little boys. I got to keep this in mind. Yeah. As a proponent of deep work, I don't want to.
It makes sense, right?
It makes tons, and that's what's happening at the adult level too, I guess, mm-hmm. right? I mean, if you constantly need novel stimuli, then what happens when you need a deep work, which is going to not give you a lot of novel stimuli? If your brain is used to that addiction, I mean, we can't blame it for saying, I can't pay attention to this. I need stimuli. I get it all the time. Why is this suddenly different than all the rest of the day?
Yeah. Yeah. Awesome. Well, Cal, here's the final question. Same question that I ask every single one of our guests. And that is, what does it mean to you specifically to lead a meaningful life?
Yeah, that is a good question. I mean, I guess, for me, when I think about meaning, especially in the professional world, it's, you know, doing something that that matters, and doing it well, and doing it for the right reasons. That, to me, that creates a meaningful life. And it's, you know, doing something well, doing something that has impact. I really don't see any way to do that if you don't have, you know, a deep work ability that's right there in your toolbox.
Awesome. Awesome. Love it. Well, Deep Work, guys, comes out on January 5th. You can pick it up. I'll link up all this stuff over at meaningfulhq.com for you. And Cal, where can our readers, listeners contact you or get in touch and learn more about you and your work if they wanted to?
Well, on calnewport.com, you can find about the book, but I also have a blog on there in which I write a lot about this topic and the different type of strategies that work. Fortunately or unfortunately, because I value deep work so much, I'm otherwise kind of hard to get in touch with. I don't have any social media accounts or general purpose email addresses. So I might be hard to get in touch with, but that's only because I feel seriously about the stuff I write about.
In other words, go read his blog, calnewport.com. Awesome, Cal. Thank you so much for doing this interview. I appreciate it. I know our listeners appreciated it. And hopefully we can connect again for the next book.
All right. Thanks, Dean.
It's Dean. Listen, I hope you enjoyed this episode of the podcast. If you found this episode inspiring, or if anything else you've heard on the show has helped you or made an impact on your life in any way, I'd really appreciate it if you showed me a little love with a quick review over on iTunes or on whichever podcast platform you tune into the show on. Every single review helps us reach and inspire more people to live like they give a damn. Listen, if you've got self-help questions of your own that you'd like me to answer live on the podcast, hit me up over at meaningfulhq.com. You can submit them over on the contact page, or you can just shoot your questions directly to me at questions@deanbakari.com. Thanks again so much for subscribing, sharing, and tuning into the show. I've said it before, I'll say it again. It's because of you and tens of thousands of other listeners from around the world tuning in every single week, week after week, day after day, that we are able to continue creating content to help you crush it and make an impact in your life and at work. So thank you for being part of this and continuing to share the podcast with your friends, your family, and anyone else you think it could help. Until next time, this is Dean Bakari telling you to go out there every single day and live like you give a damn.